This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jacob Barrett, and today I have the pleasure to be talking with Jason Bivens about his recent book, Embattled America, The Rise of Anti-Politics and America's Obsession with Religion, that came out in July 2022 with Oxford University Press. Jason, welcome to the podcast, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jacob.
I wanted to start, you mentioned at the beginning of your book that you started this book back in 2009, and then after a few detours and other projects, you returned to it with different motivations than you set out when you began the book. Why did you write this book, and why did you write this book now?
Great question. So let me tell you a little bit about how this was shaping up circa 2008-2009. In 2008, Religion of Fear was published, and you know, I see... Three of my four books have to do with political religions in the United States, and I see them as connected in a certain sense. So I began in 2008, as we all sort of thought through the Obama election, what that might have meant, and ultimately did not mean for American politics. I began to think about where some of the cultures of conspiracy thinking, of, you know, rejection of the commons, the undermining of shared institutions and norms that I've been documenting since the 90s, I began to think about where that might go. Because in response to Obama's ascent, what I and quite frankly, tens of millions of other people noticed was a kind of recrudescence of these persecution claims on the evangelical right. And I wanted to document them, but sort of in my way, think about them through a series of theories and if you like, sort of fugitive impulses that were outside of the gaze of the conventional scholar and conventional media. So I started to think about these categories in the book, these non-ideological or even post-ideological categories, martyrs and whistleblowers. As this was happening, and I'd be delighted to talk about those categories more, as this was happening, Twitter was kind of taking hold. Facebook had led to Twitter and so on and so forth. And I became very concerned about the degradation of academic discourse that I was then witnessing. Now, as a non-Twitter user, I'm also well aware that academic Twitter, at least until the last year or so, with all of the Eloning of things, academic Twitter has gotten rather excellent in many ways. But at the time, I was sort of, I'm not a technophobe, I'm not a Luddite, but I was concerned about, you know, the whole world of 120, 140 characters. And so I wanted to write about persecution claims, embattlement claims, in the most theoretically overdetermined complex way that I could. So I was using affect theory, Latourian network theory, and I wanted to sort of bring all those resources to the table as a statement of what academic discourse could be, despite all of the technological changes. And then I got burnt out. I just got burnt out on politics. You know, I mean, I think it was on a trip back to Indiana. I was listening to, you know, with like white knuckling on the steering wheel. I was waiting to hear the Supreme Court's decision on the ACA, which, you know, that's ultimately good. And I was just, you know, I thought to myself, man, I don't know that I can really do this project right now. And then Tom Tweed and Bob Orsi both separately encouraged me to get back to the jazz thing. So I did the jazz thing, and I thought, man, maybe things will change. And Obama got reelected, and I was really grinding on the jazz research. And I thought, maybe things will be okay. Maybe things will get at least a little bit better. And then 2016 happened, and I thought, wow, not only did none of these case studies that I had begun to sketch out, Glenn Beck, Sarah Palin, the Tea Party, I had this anxiety previously that they might have faded into obscurity, and then they came roaring back. So I said, right, it is now emphatically time to revisit this. But the book, as you know, is not shorn of theory in any way whatsoever, but I came to a different set of presuppositions, and I wanted to really say something about American politics rather than simply document a phenomenon of concern. So that really, in a sort of long-winded answer, that's what I thought it was time for me to make a major statement about American democracy. And this book was my opportunity to do so.
Yeah. And it's such an impressive book. I think what struck me was that it's exactly what you said, very theoretically savvy, and there's a lot of important theory happening, but also really timely examples, and it feels very very relevant to this moment, and kind of taking the theoretical conversations and saying, and this is why it matters, to like, it's not just some abstract conversation, it's happening here, which I think is really important. Kind of, you hinted at this a little bit with what you were saying. The first chapter of the book is called Changing the Subject. And you make a compelling argument that most of the approaches taken towards a conversation about religion and contemporary American politics have gotten it backwards. You hinted at it a little bit, but what do you see as the mainstream approach to that topic, where it goes wrong? And then what's the intervention that you're hoping to make in that?
Yes, thank you so much for that question. And this is one that I've been wrestling with for my entire scholarly life. As somebody who is a bit of a political junkie, a DC native, I've often been perplexed at how, even in our wing of the academy, there are some, I think maybe not entirely off-base approaches to the role of religion in politics, so much as obviously incomplete approaches, which is to say that as vital as it is to study how social groups get formed, how policy issues are advanced, and certainly, you know, dear to your heart and my heart, how constitutional issues are adjudicated and debated in American life, I've always been concerned with, I would say, the slow and sometimes less obvious moving of tectonic plates that lead us to places where we feel as if our condition is inevitable. You know, hence the seeming ubiquity of embattlement claims, persecution claims. So I would say that the standard approaches, and I wouldn't want to name any particular author, the standard approaches to assessing our moments, which is to say, roughly speaking, the post 9/11 era, focus on Christian nationalism, focus on the ideological transformations of the Republican Party, all of which, these are extremely important phenomena, of course. I wouldn't want to deny the existence of these things. But I have been concerned as a citizen, as an activist, as a person, and as a scholar, and as somebody who was raised in a very progressive religious household, which is still a large part of my identity, I've been concerned with the transformation and the degradation of democracy itself. And so as I took stock of the phenomena that I describe in the book, but also the public reception of these phenomena, Tea Party Sarah Palin, lesser known figures like David Barton, and in previous books, you know, homeschooling and things like this, I've been concerned about, quite frankly, Jacob, bad interpretations. Interpretations that seem to miss the mark as far as the seriousness of the implications for democracy itself go. So what I wanted to do was figure out, behind the conversations about these moments of spectacle, what are the democratic stakes in play? That was really my motivation. And in that, my hope was that however many people read the book, take the book seriously or what have you, all these things out of an author's control, my hope was that I would do something fresh and honest and distinctive.
Yeah. Well, and I think you mentioned kind of the categories that you use to talk about these different groups as martyrs and whistleblowers. And you move away from kind of discussing clear-cut, you know, conservatives or liberals or the right and the left, that sort of thing, which I think the move to find a new language is really useful, especially when you're not only trying to talk about something differently, but really see something differently, you know, that kind of removing that language that structures so much of what the problem is that you identify, you know, just like getting rid of it and finding a different language to talk about becomes really useful. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by martyrs and whistleblowers and what those categories allow you to do versus using some other different kind of conservative liberal binary?
Yeah, thank you. I'm really glad that you find it useful. I suppose at the most basic level, my shift to these terms, and I've never really been comfortable with you know, the old dyad of conservative and liberal, as central as it is to our lives, obviously. But one of the things that is, I think, foremost in my mind, you know, even after the publication of the book, is the I was about to say near total, but the absence of satisfying and effective modes of citizenship for Americans. And there are a lot of reasons for that, institutional reasons and otherwise, that I go into in the book. So at the most basic level, I wanted to understand why the claims, the petitions of martyrdom or near martyrdom that we encounter on the right, why these are effective surrogates for what I would regard as authentic democratic action and citizenship. I wanted to understand why the self-satisfied identification of seeming conservative hypocrisy that we find on the left, you know, the talking left, the typing left, to use Jody Dean's excellent phrase. I wanted to understand why those were satisfying for, broadly speaking, liberals who otherwise might not be doing much of anything at all in terms of citizenship. And I thought not only were those categories, I think, central to these modes of sort of non-civic participation, non-civic discourse, I also think they're clear examples of or evidences of the blasted, the rubble of anti-politics that now passes for public life in the United States. You know, so we have this absolute overgrowth of corporate politics, you know, the political parties are in the thrall of the lobbies and so on and so forth. So I wanted to sort of find a different way of narrating how citizens fight with each other, quite simply.
Yeah. And I think it was really useful to me as I was reading, because I think especially the language of like conservative and liberal, like in the same way that when we talk about, you know, when we deploy the term religion, like we think we know what it means and it's come to mean so many different things that don't get interrogated or questioned. And so then we're saying the same words and we're talking about different things, but we don't really know we're talking about different things. And yeah, so I thought I really appreciated your move to kind of think with martyrs and whistleblowers, especially because that also feels those are active words. You know, it's not necessarily ideological, but it's more like, how are you using martyr narratives? How are you whistleblowing? You know, that feels important.
Yeah, exactly. And the activeness of those terms and the ways in which those terms enable citizen practitioners, interlocutors, to construct a particular history, to construct a particular institutional narrative, and so on and so forth, right? I think that signaled me to the ways in which even the journalistic pivot to tribalism was less than wholly satisfying. And I think you really put your finger on it a few minutes ago when in opening this line of conversation, you mentioned being sort of trapped in a particular language. And I think that really is what I was going for, whether or not I successfully articulated it in the book. You know, because we have no satisfying or efficient outlets for our own civic activism, because, you know, to be an American in this moment is to feel overwhelmingly impotent, overwhelmingly just unable to make change. There's a kind of desperate quality to being an American today. You know, we're just trapped, you know, in the book, I call it, you know, this flag wrapped brokenness, you know, one of my sort of poetic moments, right? And I just feel like because there's such a lack, there's something about these two discourses, the sizzle, you know, life as action movie, that provides catharsis in the face of nothing else.
Yeah. And I want to highlight too, one of the other, I mean, the title of your book is Embattled America, and this idea of embattlement and embattlement narratives is really important throughout. Can you just talk a little bit about what you mean by that, about what embattlement is to you and why it's useful?
Yeah, so the original title was actually Embattled Majority. And I was interested in how both martyrs and whistleblowers claim to represent the majoritarian American viewpoint and are unjustly embattled. So embattlement claims for me taps into this long history whereby different groups of Americans are simultaneously and endlessly claiming to be frozen out of public life, to be the victim of an activist judiciary. It's the endlessness of that trope and the sort of stunning and yet entirely unsurprising way in which nothing ever changes despite the recurrence of those claims. And so what embattlement means to me is the formation of an identity, the coalescence of a subject position, the overwhelmingness of what I call the world, the ability to sort of stake out a position that is at least temporarily resilient in the face of all this ongoing data. So embattlement is a framework and not a reality. But I also didn't want to get trapped in this kind of like salon.com, I'm going to expose you for not being embattled. I'm going to document your annual income and so on and so forth. Because I think, you know, one of the things that became apparent to me while I was revising this during lockdown and so forth was that, and this is one of the ways books work, right? Sometimes you don't figure out some of your central claims until the very end. Whistleblowers fuel the martyr narrative always and everywhere. So the way to get, and back to your original question about changing the subject, if we as citizens are concerned about changing things, and if we as citizens believe that one of the least fruitful public and political conversations in American life is the conversation about evangelical persecution or embattlement, then the best way to get out of that condition is to absolutely avoid the conversation altogether, because even to bring it up to disprove it would be to give it more life.
Yeah, that is spot on. In addition to this theoretical framework that you pulled together, there's a wide range of examples throughout the book, from political moments and figures to pop culture, viral internet moments. And I think that was, it felt, sometimes you read a book with lots of examples and it feels like kind of a grab bag of whatever's there. And that's not what this felt like. This felt like the examples that you were drawing on in the wide range of examples contributed to your larger argument about kind of the everywhereness of these whistleblower martyr dynamics. So my question is, how did you settle on the examples that you were going to use? And why was it important, I guess, to use so many different, not only different examples, but different types of examples?
Mm-hmm. I think the best way to answer that question is just to point out some features of my personality, which is to say, this is the way that I've always worked. I'm sort of an omnivore when it comes to American life. And since I was an undergraduate at Oberlin College, I've just kept notebooks filled with observations. And as I was going through this, and again, this book has had the longest gestation of anything I've ever worked on, and that'll likely remain true. You know, I had like notes upon notes, documents upon documents, and I would just sort of, you know, write down, oh, hey, you know, there's this Cardi B lyric, or, you know, there's this moment from American Idol or what have you. And I really think it has to do with the ways in which even those Americans who don't actively speak the language of martyrdom or whistleblowing, the depth and the permeation of these ideas is evident everywhere. So in a sense, if the world is my archive, which it kind of is, you know, from a comment section to, you know, getting back to an earlier technological era, you know, a blog roll or something like this, there are certain moments that quite simply pop for me. You know, the Braveheart being a sort of obvious one. But I really do think that particularly since the 1990s, as politics has gotten more corporatized and hollowed out and saturated with fear and so forth, we start to see refractions of and deflections of authenticity in perhaps sometimes the most unlikely places. I hope that's a coherent answer.
Yeah, definitely. And I think too that the examples that you used as well, like they're not just, I like that you said the world as your archive, that you also draw a lot on personal anecdotes, personal experiences, how you move through the world and have experienced things. As I was reading, it was surprising because I don't bump up against that in scholarly texts often, especially scholarly texts that are so theoretically structured. Why was it important for you to put yourself in this book as yourself, as a citizen, as a, you know, not just Jason Bivens, scholar of American religion, but Jason Bivens as person living in this world and experiencing these things as well?
Right. And wishing we weren't living in this world and experiencing things. Yeah, I think, it's such a great question because, for me, I think about the structure of the field. And, you know, behind your comment just now, you know, I hear your reference to genres of religious studies in which the authorial eye is more common, which is to say probably ethnography, which is a genre that I love, but do not practice. That eye has been in all of my books to a certain extent. In the jazz book, it's because I'm a participant in the broad world of jazz performance and criticism. And that's the book in which I get closest to ethnography. But in terms of Embattled America and its relationship to the previous two politics books, it's because I'm trying really hard to carve out a role for social criticism in religious studies. And I really think, all of us are concerned to bring our skills and our knowledge, our sensibilities to the table. All of us are concerned with mattering. And there are various ways in which each of us is going to identify zones in which that would be productive, but for me, I feel like I've sort of been creeping around the edge of some normative claims for a long time. And I thought, if I'm going to get there, the eye makes sense. I think it's not necessarily an anecdotal eye, but in a certain sense, I'm identifying myself as a person who is trying to articulate a platform for political reform, civic reform, and to do so in a different tone would have seemed to me inauthentic. But the other part of the answer, I would say, and this does come through in the book, is that, as I was really refining these arguments on January 6th, 2021, I got all these texts from friends of mine, and I was filled with, as somebody who grew up with a 5-minute walk from the Capitol, I was filled with rage, absolute, uncompromising rage. And I thought, right, this is my moment, and I'm going to take the moment, and whatever happens is what happens.
Yeah. Well, and I think, too, the book strikes me, and this it strikes me as important, in a conversation about kind of the role of scholarship in greater society.
Right.
And that, it kind of, to me, originally I'd thought of it as like, oh, this is the bridge between the scholar activist dichotomy, or, this is the answer to scholar activist debates about, what's that role. But as I'm sitting and thinking, I don't even think that that's true, that I think this is, to me, it feels like wanting to, in this move to restructure and think differently about the dynamics, that it moves away from even understanding scholar activists as a binary, or as two things that, like, when do you put your scholar hat on? When do you put your activist hat on? When do you put your citizen hat on? It kind of moves us out of that realm entirely.
Yeah, I like that very much. I simply think, and I wouldn't want to condone my methods as sort of normative for the field or anything like this. I can only do me. But I do have to say, I do personally find it dissatisfying when people write about political religions with no edge. And if you're, this can look a whole number of different ways. For example, You can do great scholarship on racial alterity in the 19th century, as Catherine Jin Lum does. You know, I mean, you know, that's pretty edgy stuff. You know, I wouldn't want to say that it has to be engaged with the present or it has to be theoretically inclined, as my work is. But I do think it's odd when people write about political religions in the U.S. as if it was just some sort of merely intellectual enterprise. I mean, look at what's happening, after all.
Kind of in the same vein of what you were just talking about, you start your book saying that you're tired of scholarship and politics both, telling us that things need to change and we need to do something different, without giving a map of what comes next, of how to move forward, what that change looks like. And so then appropriately, you end with your version of what that change can look like and some practical steps on how we get there. So my question is kind of twofold, of what are some of those steps that you see as moving forward? But also, how do those steps get us out of this embattlement discourse that you identify as the main problem?
Oh man, this is really the heart of the book for me, you know, and I tried to do it, you know, in each of the chapters. I say this thing is really about representation, and I tried to do a little bit of that in each of the case study chapters, but it has its roots in two, I think, unforgettable moments for me, right? So even, you know, when this thing was on hold, I was still giving talks about it, and I was invited out to Colorado. And Ira Chernus in Colorado, I got to give him a shout out. You know, he's in the acknowledgments. Ira's this great scholar of pacifism and civil religion and all this other stuff. And we were at dinner afterwards. And you know, he's I think emeritus now. Anyway, he's a generation or so older than I am. And he's a really good dude. And he said to me, "Are you ever going to say something positive about America?" And you know, I hemmed and hawed my way through an answer. But boy, that stuck with me. And positive, it wasn't necessarily, you know, rosy or optimistic in this sense. Are you ever going to say something that's not merely interpretative, is how I took his question. So I just kind of stuck that back there. And then a few years later, I was working for the Great Courses. I was doing one of those, you know, video courses and 24 lectures. And my editor at the Great Courses said, "Right, we want your final lecture to tell us what to do." And I was so bummed about that. I was so reluctant. But in my mind, that's when Ira's comment got resurrected. And so I started thinking constructively as I pieced together this one lecture. And I came up with, you know, which is not to say the material is the same, right? But I came up with this fourfold schema, which is self, community, nation, world, right? It's an obvious schema, but it's the way that I was thinking about it. And as I was thinking, as very much a not policy person, you know, I have friends in the policy world and so on and so forth, but I know that's not where my strengths are or even where my competencies are. And I knew that I wasn't going to make an argument as to how structural change can happen. You know, I don't have a roadmap for, you know, overturning Citizens United or anything like this. But what I do have, I hope, is a series of arguments to people and for people as to why politics is actually worth it. Because I think one of the things that's gotten us to this blasted moment in American history is that we've given up on the very possibility of change. And somehow through all of this madness of the past few years, I've discovered that I'm still an idealist, which is why I'm angry all the time. And I thought, what we can all do, regardless of money or anything else, is we can begin with this process of self-inventory. What are we doing? Each of us individually, what am I, Jason Bivens, doing? What are you, Jacob Barrett, doing to contribute to the appalling nature of civic discourse? And maybe the answer is nothing, but I think we have an absolute responsibility as each of us citizen custodians of American democracy in a time when it's really bad. I think we have an obligation to undergo this process all the time, with our students, with our fellow citizens, with people we meet in the Harris Teeter. What do you got? And to seek out opportunities for meaningful collaboration on the community level. And my hope is that if those two levels start functioning, and for we academics, maybe that means, you know, reaching out to a church or something like that, having a teach-in or something like this. Those things are really, really fun, I find. I love connecting with citizen groups, you know, the things that we don't put on our CV, but matter more than the things that we put on our CV, in my judgment. I think we do have power at the local level. And if direct democracy can experience at least some kind of revival, I wouldn't want to say there's necessarily a trickle-up effect, but things can get better. I genuinely believe that.
And I think that's was the general tone that I really appreciated throughout this book, was that even as I, you know, when I picked it up and was reading through it, I spent a lot of my time reading about American politics. And when I'm not reading for school about American politics, I'm scrolling on Twitter and I'm seeing stuff, and, you know, and things get doom and gloomy really fast. And then I also kind of, like, my stomach hurts a little bit when it's the, like, too sweet version of a, oh, and this is how we make a perfect world, and this is the solution. And so I really appreciated the book as a very grounded move through an analysis and diagnosis of what's happening without being the doom and gloom and pointing in a direction, maybe not the only direction, maybe not, but opening the door to say, how do we imagine new? Because that's the first step, I think, really is having being able to recognize that we can imagine new, and then taking those steps is really important.
Yeah, that's my hope. You know, I mean, I really believe in involvement. I believe in people, weirdly enough. You know, the astounding capacity for cruelty that's on display every day in this country, you know. I mean, all the things I think about as a man in his 50s, you know, I'm astounded every day that we're still dealing with the things that we're dealing with. As a scholar, neither you nor I are surprised. We can trace the historical roots of these things. But it's absolutely appalling that in this, you know, the wealthiest country that has ever existed, which prides itself on a certain pious self-understanding as a bastion of freedom and tolerance, that we're still dealing with homophobia and transphobia and racism and misogyny and all the rest. And it fills me with great sadness and great anger. But as a person of privilege myself, and this is really one of the things that motivates my writing and my teaching, I am not afforded the luxury of wallowing in sadness.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of where I am.
Yeah. And I think, that's really great. And I hope that the field takes note and that, as you know, as more work comes out on the contemporary moments, that scholars can begin to change the subject and think differently about where we're at and where we can be headed.
I hope so too. We occupy a really cool field. It's filled with creative people, people of good conviction. And I want more of us out there doing things that can move the needle, quite frankly.
Yeah. Well, that's all I have. Do you have any concluding messages that you want to send out into the world? I think that's a pretty good place to land it.
I think it's a pretty good place too.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being with me today, Jason. This was lovely. And for everyone listening, go read this book. It was well worth the time.
Thank you so much, Jacob. It's been a real pleasure and an honor.